his eyes narrowing.
That's how it happened, Mr. Reese. I swear.
Interesting. Reese paused before continuing. How did you ever hope to get something like this approved? The FDA isn't going to accept results from some drug that you tested on people without their consent. I'm no expert, but I know there are all kinds of standards that have to be met. Phase one, phase two, all of that.
That would be true normally, but when the president names the head of the FDA and they want a drug approved during wartime to help every man and woman in uniform, no one is going to ask a lot of tough questions.
So now you're telling me that the president is involved? Is the freaking Queen of England also part of this conspiracy?
No, not this president. The next president. Secretary Hartley.
No way, Reese thought. How in the hell did I get mixed up in this shit show? How did you get us to take it? I didn't take any pills or anything on this deployment.
Remember the tactical performance study that your team participated in?
Yeah, they took our VO2 max and ran a bunch of cognitive tests on us.
That was a cover for this. The vitamin B12 shots you were given in the second half of that study were actually RD-4895. We did a baseline physical and psychological assessment. We assumed that everything was going well until the blood work came back from the last battery of tests before your troop deployed. White blood cell counts for a bunch of your men were off the charts, and there were various other abnormalities that indicated that the compound hadn't been fixed.
And that's when Boykin made the call to pull the plug and have us all killed.
I don't know. I really don't, Mr. Reese.
Saul managed to get out through his tears.
How do you know so much about Marcus?
I found out about him a few days before I put a bullet through his brain in Wyoming.
Oh my God, this is real. He's really going to kill us all.
Though Saul said nothing, his expression betrayed it all. How do you arrange a Taliban ambush halfway across the globe? You guys cut Haji in on the billions?
We left it up to Pilsner on how to clean things up. All through Tedesco and Horn. They got to know each other through all those high-end fundraisers they throw for you guys for the foundations and charities. And that stuff is big business.
So Pilsner sets us up for an ambush and gets a bunch of Rangers and Army aircrew killed for good measure. How the hell did he manage that?
I don't know. Exactly. Mr. Reese, I just know that's how it went down.
Saul took another long gulp of the bourbon. And Boozer and I survive.
Yes. So Josh Holder makes your man's death look like a suicide, leaving only you remaining.
What about Chinatown? How did you find me?
The SecDef. She allocated a UAV to track you.
What? She diverted a national drone asset to help kill me?
I swear it's true, Mr. Reese, I swear.
Who is Humza Kamir?
Who?
Humza Kamir. The man you sent to kill me in Chinatown.
I didn't even know his name until you just mentioned it. That's the SecDef's asset. I have no idea. Somebody they radicalize online in case they need some dirty work done that can be attributed to Islam.
Reese shook his head in disbelief. Could that possibly be true? Say that again. They do what?
They have this program where they radicalize at-risk individuals from target populations. They recruit them to what they think is a radical Islamic movement and then use them as expendable assets. I know it sounds crazy, but it's true. I swear.
Reese paused as the gravity of what Agnan had just told him sank in. Are you certain? Reese asked, his voice icy and pointed.
I couldn't believe it either when I first found out about it. In fact, I'm not even supposed to know about it. I wish I didn't. I think the Hartleys might have created it. I don't know. I just know it exists.
Where do the Mexicans fit into all of this?
They were just contract labor. This isn't the movies where you hire a hitman to kill someone. We pay some of the cops to make the arrangements with gang types to do it. Mr. Reese, I'm...
Reese cut him off. Don't fucking do it.
Don't even sit there and apologize for having my pregnant wife and baby girl shot down in our home by some fucking drug cartel. Trust me when I tell you that you don't want to do that.
Agnan sat silently staring at the floor in front of Rhys.
If this doesn't work, Rhys asked, resuming his interrogation, how are you planning to make money on it? You gotta be throwing some serious numbers at all these collaborators to get them to risk everything. How are they going to get paid if the drug is no good?
Well, now the drug works. There are no efficacy issues, at least not on the latest test rats in India. It's proving to be over 20% more effective than placebo. As for the adverse events, the tumors, we are confident that we have addressed that in the latest version of the product. The most recent test population has shown no such signs.
You mean to tell me that you've tried this thing on another group of unwilling people? More seals?
Yes, Admiral Pilsner arranged for another group of candidates, and they are doing just fine.
You bastards!
Rhys shot back, his voice laced with venom. It took all his strength not to snatch the life from Horn's underling then and there. Regaining his composure, he continued.
Okay, let's keep going. You haven't said much about your boss. Tell me more about Steve Horn.
Agnan took a deep breath.
Mr. Horn is a genius. He sees potential in things that others don't, and he's relentless when he wants something. When he hears that
I've been murdered, he's going to go into hiding and hire every security contractor on the planet to hunt you down. You'll never get to him.
That's where you're wrong, Saul. I'm not going to murder you.
The look on Saul's face was a priceless mask of hope and shocked disbelief. Rhys poured Saul another drink and grilled him for another hour about places, names, dates, everything he could think of that would be helpful in his quest. Saul's speech increasingly slurred and his eyes narrowed to small slits. Eventually his head pitched forward as he passed out in the chair from the exhaustive waterboarding and the subsequent alcohol consumption. Satisfied that he had what he needed, Rhys decided it was time for Saul Agnan to leave this world. Rhys opened his nylon pack and began laying out the instruments that would bring about the untimely death of Mr. Horn's compliant assistant. A lighter, a syringe, a metal spoon, a length of surgical tubing, and a small Ziploc bag containing powder. Rhys wrapped the tubing around Agnan's left upper arm and tied it off tightly. He took the spoon to the bathroom where he filled it partially with water from the sink before emptying the contents of the baggie into it, forming a paste. Holding the spoon above the lighter, Rhys watched the water boil the powder into a thin liquid. He then dipped in the tip of the syringe and pulled back the plunger, drawing the mixture into the plastic cylinder. Rhys had done enough first aid training to be able to find a vein, and he quickly stuck the needle into the most prominent blood vessel protruding from the crook of Saul's arm. He pulled back on the plunger slightly, and blood flowed into the syringe, spiraling through the liquid contents like the lava lamps Rhys loved as a kid. He pushed down on the plunger, sending the liquid death into Agnan's bloodstream. As the methadone, alprazolam, and carisoprodol flowed into Agnan's brain, they inhibited the respiratory response centers already hampered by his body's metabolization of alcohol. The mixture of chemicals had a cumulative effect on the brain's ability to measure carbon dioxide. Agnan's brain no longer sent the signal to his lungs that he needed to exchange carbon dioxide for oxygen, and his body quite literally forgot to breathe. His death came quickly. Rhys placed the needle, as well as the rest of the drug paraphernalia, on the small table, alongside the empty liquor bottles and the half-full glass of bourbon. He pulled a trash bag from his pack, collecting the padded restraints from Agnan's hands and feet. In went the cloths that he'd used as a gag and blindfold, and finally the length of plastic wrap that still hung around Agnan's neck. He carried the bag around the entire room, looking for anything that needed to be disposed of in order to sterilize the scene. He took the wet towels from the edge of the floor and threw them haphazardly onto the urine-soaked tile floor. He tied the trash bag off and dropped it into his pack, while the tape recorder went into a small compartment on the outside. Reese did one final sweep of the room before checking Agnan's non-existent pulse and changing out of his lab clothes. Then, hanging the Do Not Disturb sign on the door, he exited into the early morning darkness. Back at the condo, Reese sat at the kitchen table, listening to the Saul Agnan interrogation tape. He made notes, stopping and rewinding the tape at more than one juncture to ensure that he had the details correct. If this was a lie, it was a well-crafted one. If it was the truth, it was mind-blowing. After reviewing his notes, Reese pulled a piece of paper from the bag in his pocket and removed the list. He unfolded it and looked at Lucy's drawing before turning it over and smoothing it flat on the table. With the pencil he'd been carrying in the bag, he drew a line through Agnan's name. He then added more names to the list based on his notes from his interrogation. Josh Holder, Marcus Boykin, Saul Agnan, Steve Horn, CJNG Mexico, Admiral Gerald Pilsner, Mike Tedesco, J.D. Hartley, Lorraine Hartley. It was time to take Marco del Toro up on his generous offer. Chapter 44, Palm Springs, California. The housekeeper had respected the Do Not Disturb sign on the door of Casita 134 the previous day, but it was now well after the guest's appointed checkout time on Sunday, and she had cleaned and restocked all the other rooms on her list. She tapped loudly on the door with her keycard. Housekeeping! But for the sound of classical music playing softly somewhere inside the room, silence.
Housekeeping!
Nothing.
Housekeeping! I am coming inside!
She inserted her master keycard into the slot and the lock clicked open. Reaching into the room and turning on the light as she swung the door open, her peripheral vision caught a human form slumped in a chair. She began to apologize for her intrusion until her eyes focused on the dead man, an odor the likes of which she had never experienced, shocking her system.
Dios mio!
She slammed the door shut and ran screaming for her supervisor. When homicide detective Anthony Gutierrez arrived, the responding patrol officers had already cordoned off the scene. The officer outside the door nodded at the detective and motioned him inside the room where another officer was waiting. The smell of death hit Gutierrez's nostrils as soon as he crossed through the doorway. A quick glance at the body established that calling EMS had been a waste of time and resources. The departed was naked, and his entire body was devoid of color except for his lower legs, which looked to be filled with dark red wine. Gravity had caused the man's blood, no longer under pressure from a beating heart, to pool in his legs. His eyes were closed and his mouth was open. But for the startling lack of color, the look on his face made him appear to be asleep. The manner of his death was apparent from the array of drug paraphernalia on the table beside him. A syringe, a soot-colored metal spoon with the dried residue of what was likely either prescription drugs or heroin, a Bic lighter, a cocktail glass containing a small amount of brown liquid, and empty liquor bottles that appeared to be from the room's minibar. Surgical tubing was wrapped tightly around the body's left bicep, and a puncture wound was evident on the forearm.
"Another overdose, detective?" asked the patrol officer almost rhetorically.
"Yeah, I'd say that's pretty obvious. Anything else in the room?"
"Nothing out of the ordinary. There's some puke on the floor over there, piss all over the bathroom. Looks like this guy was partying pretty hard."
"Who is he?"
The officer glanced down at a pocket-sized notebook.
"His ID and the name badge from his conference say he's Saul Agnan from L.A. The resort manager confirmed the room was booked in that name by a guy attending some lawyer conference. When's the last time anyone saw him alive? All of the attendees have left the conference, but according to the maid, he had a do not disturb sign on his door all day yesterday. Maid came in at approximately 2:35 this afternoon to clean the room and saw the body. She says she didn't touch anything. My guess is he's been dead since sometime Friday night.
I'd agree based on the body.
I'll call around to some of the folks at the conference and see if we can find out anything, but my guess is that this is a straight-up accidental overdose. Probably heroin or poly substance. It's nothing like Northern California, but we still get at least one of these a month. 30-something white guys are dropping like flies.
Can't imagine injecting yourself with that shit. It makes my skin crawl.
The officer winced at the mere thought.
Addiction is a powerful force. This guy's a lawyer, probably makes more scratch than both of us put together. And he dies butt naked in a hotel room trying to get high.
Detective Gutierrez shook his head.
I'll snap some pictures. Call the ME and we'll get him bagged up and out of here.
Chapter 45. Point Loma, California. Reese slowed his Land Cruiser and eased into a parking space off the main drag in Point Loma, just across the bay from Naval Air Station North Island, the Navy's large real estate holding that occupied the majority of Coronado Island. Reese had always liked Point Loma. There were some beautiful homes here, with great views of San Diego, its bay, Coronado, and the Pacific. He loved the smell of the ocean, and Point Loma was San Diego's maritime metropolis. He drove by the front gate to the Marine Corps recruiting depot, one of two boot camps where young recruits began their journey into the Corps. Crossing streets with names like Nimitz, Farragut, and Roosevelt, he passed yacht builders, boat repair shops, the exclusive San Diego Yacht Club, and a host of fishermen preparing for yet another day at sea. Traffic had been light this early on a weekday, but Reese knew that a certain local coffee shop would be open and ready for business. The coffee shop looked like a small Victorian house, which it had been at some point years ago. With two stories and a charming front deck, it could easily have been mistaken for an historic home, rather than the small batch roaster it was. The inside was as appealing as the outside, with large overstuffed chairs and couches arranged among antique coffee tables of just the appropriate size. The walls were adorned with an assortment of old books, which always made Reese feel comfortable and at home. As early as it was, Reese was not the first customer of the day. A girl in her early 20s sat pecking away at her laptop, probably a student from Point Loma Nazarene University, just up and over the hill, while across the room sat a grizzled old fisherman deep in thought. Reese ordered a large black coffee. Ordinarily, he would have added something sweet, but today he ordered it the same way his friend, who usually accompanied him to this particular coffee shop, would do it. Reese smiled, recalling how his larger companion would always make some comment about guys who spruce up their coffee, as he shook his head watching Reese add honey or sugar with a dash of cream, or worse yet, adding nothing because he ordered a latte. Today, that teammate wasn't there to give Reese a hard time about his coffee predilections. He was waiting for Reese farther up the road. Reese fired up the Land Cruiser and headed up the hill, turning onto Cabrillo Memorial Drive. The higher Reese climbed, the more beautiful the view became, the homes and businesses retreating to give way to the natural beauty of the Pacific coastline. Reese pulled into a small dirt lot facing east and took in the view. Naval Base Point Loma, home to San Diego's submarine fleet, was just coming to life below him, while across the bay, he had a commanding view of North Island, Coronado, downtown San Diego, Imperial Beach, and on into Mexico. His coffee sufficiently cooled, Reese rested his arm on the open window and took a sip of the strong black liquid that he was sure once flowed through the veins of the friend he had come to see. Based on the copious amounts Reese had observed him consume on a daily basis over the years. Watching a Ticonderoga-class guided missile cruiser pass through San Diego Bay into the open waters of the Pacific, Reese could not help but be impressed. That one ship contained more combat power than most small countries. Its imposing presence represented United States diplomacy abroad and traced its origins back to the Continental Navy during the Revolutionary War. To Reese, it looked like freedom. Reese allowed another smile as he thought about how his friend would have been impressed that he knew the ship below was a Ticonderoga class. Usually, when his friend would ask him to identify a certain ship and their wanderings, Reese would answer, "That's a big gray one." Reese's professional life had been spent studying the unconventional side of warfare, insurgencies, guerrilla tactics, and terrorism.